Welcome to the Behind the Sports Medicine podcast, proudly sponsored by AJR Sports Science and Healthcare Consulting. AJR offers top-tiered services in sports science analytics, healthcare consulting, and leadership development. Learn more at ajrsportscience.com. I'm your host, Andrew Rizza, an athletic trainer with over 25 years of experience in physical therapy and school athletics. I started the podcast to dive into the evolving world of sports medicine, physical therapy, athletic training, and sports science.
And I'm your co-host, Cameron Roth, a hand and upper extremity surgeon based in Phoenix and a consultant for MLB's Chicago White Sox. I'm excited to team up with my good friend Riz to explore everything from surgery, rehab, performance, and mindset. Now, on to the show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's Behind the Sports Medicine podcast. We have Dr. Mike Perrone, who's a peer and colleague of Dr. Cameron Roth. Dr. Roth had connected us probably about 6 weeks ago. I want to discuss foot and ankle pathology. Dr. Perrone was gracious enough to come on today, so we're going to talk a lot of good stuff here, which I think will be informative for the listeners. Dr. Roth?
Yeah, this is actually very special to have Dr. Mike Perrone. He and I were co-residents at the University of Chicago together. He was my senior resident. He's originally from New York and then obtained his undergraduate degree from the University of Florida, and then graduated med school, staying in the state of Florida at the University of South Florida. And then in 2019, he's completed his orthopedic surgery residency at the prestigious University of Chicago in South Side, Chicago. And then he went on to his orthopedic sports medicine fellowship at one of the best sports medicine fellowships in the world at the world-renowned Curlin Jobe Orthopedic Institute in Los Angeles, where he was associate team physician for multiple Los Angeles area professional and college sports teams. He then took some extra time at the other prestigious Stedman Clinic and Stedman Philpon Research Institute in Vail, doing sports, foot and ankle, and trauma, where he was an associate team physician for the U.S. ski and snowboard team. Currently, he is a sports foot and ankle and knee surgeon in Los Angeles at the Los Angeles Orthopedic Surgery Specialist. He's a rising star in sports medicine knee, sports medicine foot and ankle. He's a friend, he's a mentor, he's a colleague, and we're really lucky to have him on to ask him a bunch of questions and hopefully help our listeners. So, Dr. Perrone, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here. And thanks for all the kind words, half of which are true.
That's always good. You got to always wonder what's coming out of Dr. Roth and whether it's fiction or fact. But I have to say, knowing him for as long as I have, it's more fact than fiction. So, Dr. Perrone, thanks again. I do appreciate you coming on today.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, I've known you for a long time, so I meant it all for sure.
Can you give us a little bit more about kind of where your practice is kind of at now?
Originally, when I started, I was doing a mix of everything as I was building my practice, you know, being sports trained. I had very good experience in shoulder and elbow. You know, Curlin Jobe is where the Tommy John surgery was invented in, and some would say perfected. So we got a great experience with our throwing athletes. We had a good hip arthroscopy experience. But one thing that I was always interested in coming out of UChicago was foot and ankle. We definitely got a good amount of trauma in foot and ankle at UChicago, but not so much from the sports perspective. When I went to Curlin Jobe, there was one attending there that I was their sports foot and ankle attending, and I was able to work with him a bit. But again, it just didn't feel like enough for me in terms of getting the education I need to kind of focus more on sports foot and ankle. So there was an opportunity available at the Stedman Clinic in Vail with Drs. Hate Manick and Dr. Clanton. And that was one of the most amazing training experiences I had. You know, just getting to work exclusively with two attendings, focusing on sports foot and ankle and trauma really just kind of helped round out my training. So coming into practice, I was capturing a little bit of everything. But as I got busy with, you know, sports knee, sports foot and ankle, I slowly started shifting towards just becoming a lower extremity surgeon. So most of my patients, you know, they range anywhere from age, you know, 14 to mid 60s, athletes of all ages and skills, acute injuries, chronic injuries. For the more acute injuries, we kind of get them in as soon as, you know, we deem necessary. For the more chronic ones, those can kind of, you know, wait till those can be done in a more elective fashion. So I'm in my fourth year of practice. I'm at a point where I'm nice and steady, nice and busy, and just kind of, you know, having a lot of fun taking care of these, like I said, these athletes of all ages.
Something that we see commonly, I know Riz sees commonly in the training room at Weston and at the physical therapy facility, and you'll see it urgent care in the emergency department. I'm sure you see a lot of in your clinic are ankle sprains, incredibly common. So how would you give us an overall definition of ankle sprains, low versus high? And then how do you generally assess whether these can be treated conservatively or non-operatively, or is this something that may be needed to deal with in an operative fashion?
Yeah, as you alluded to, you have multiple different types of ankle sprains. You know, the most common reason for ER visits from an orthopedic standpoint are low ankle sprains. But, you know, you also have to be sure that you're not missing, you know, your high ankle sprain or even, you know, these kind of more zebra type injuries like your peroneal tendon dislocations. So, you know, as you guys know, the most important thing is just history and physical, right? So, you know, you take a look at the athlete, you take a look at the patient. You see where their bruising is, you see where their swelling is, you ask where their pain is. I ask them what their mechanism of injury is, because usually that will be the most insightful for helping delineate, you know, whether this is a low or a high ankle sprain. You know, your low ankle sprains are usually inversion supination injuries. So I would tell people, did your foot go in, right? Did it curl in, or did it curl out, or did it go up and out? You know, those external rotation injuries and, you know, dorsiflexion, those are concerning for your syndesmotic injuries, your high ankle sprains. And even, you know, an important structure that most people don't talk about is the deltoid ligament, you know, on the medial side. And that usually can go in hand with your high ankle sprains. You know, like I said, I'll do my history and physical. I'll get a set of x-rays to make sure we're not dealing with a fracture. You know, usually in a low ankle sprain, you're not going to see any sign of fracturing. So occasionally you'll see a small little flex sign off of the fibula, which may, you know, it tells you that you may be dealing with an avulsion type injury. In terms of high ankle sprains, you know, these can kind of be deceptive. You might not see any radiographic findings, but in more high grade sprains, you might see widening between the fibula and the tibia. And that, you know, kind of has to make you a little more suspicious for, you know, those high ankle sprains. So kind of getting a little bit into the exam, checking for instability. They both have their special tests. You know, we all know the anterior jaw test for our low ankle sprains. There's a series of there's a multitude of tests for high ankle sprains. You're basically challenging that syndesmosis, external rotating it, trying to splay apart the tibia and the fibula. And then once I've kind of made the diagnosis, kind of graded the injury, you know, more low grade injuries, both low and high ankle sprains, I usually will start with the period of immobilization. You know, for a high ankle sprain, that usually means something like a cam boot. I'll let them be weight bearing as tolerated, you know, usually for, you know, those high ankle sprains. They're quite painful, so they're not itching to walk on them immediately, and they'll kind of self-regulate. For the low ankle sprains, I'm a little bit more aggressive with them. You know, I'll offer them use of a cam boot if they have considerable swelling, considerable pain, considerable, you know, difficulty with ambulation. But generally, I'm usually suggesting using something like an ankle brace, lace-up ankle brace, and putting them back in a regular shoe. I like that because it provides some compression, but also gives them the stability that they need to put some weight on it.
I think one of the questions I have is for the athletic trainer and physical therapist listening to this, when they have an acute ankle sprain that comes in, say it's just an ATFL, lower ankle sprain, when is the right time? I mean, we always talk about, you know, palpable tenderness, where it is, trying to get the exam. If you're an acute injury and an athletic trainer is evaluating on a sideline or in the athletic training room, when do you have that conversation of we should go get x-rays? When is it emergent? Obviously, if there's gross deformity, you're getting an x-ray. But if there isn't gross deformity there and there's some palpable pain, but it's around the ligamentous structures, as an orthopedic surgeon, when do you say the best time to get the x-ray? Because we've had conversations where somebody might have swelling, but are you going to have a false positive on an x-ray that someone has more edema or swelling versus waiting if they're non-weight bearing and starting to get treatment? And when do you make that call and when's the best way to kind of define that for the patient?
Yeah, you have your Ottawa rules that we all learn in our residency. And that's basically, you know, if the inability to bear weight, then most patients are going to get an x-ray, and then bony tenderness. Now, I think for you, when you're evaluating patients on the sideline, the heart rate's high, adrenaline is flowing, right? The injury just happened. Especially when you're dealing with more younger athletes, there might be more of a pain response, right? So for them not wanting to bear weight, that's probably a pretty common thing. They were just injured, having some point tenderness that they can't really localize. So, you know, if you're not concerned about gross deformity, then I think maybe in that setting, getting it wrapped up, getting some ice on it, it's probably the best way to go. And then later on, doing a reassessment. Now, by the time the patients get to me in clinic, you know, this is days, sometimes weeks after their initial injury. I usually start with x-ray. You know, I think the Ottawa rules, the purpose of that was, you know, to guide us in when and how we want to attain our imaging, but also to be a little bit more conservative in how we utilize resources. But, you know, I'm an orthopedic surgeon who is in an orthopedic clinic, right? X-rays are part of it. Sometimes an ankle sprain is not just an ankle sprain, like I mentioned before. So, you know, you can have your low ankle sprains that have avulsion, you can have your high ankle sprain where there's no bony component, but you can see, you know, like I said, the widening and the kind of the shifting in the structures. So for me, I'm generally getting x-ray in most patients who come to my office.
We have conversations with parents all the time. It's 6 o'clock on a Friday evening, athlete sprains an ankle, evaluating them in clinic or in the athletic training room. They have the general signs and symptoms. We'll get them iced, compression, immobilize them, get them on crutch walking precautions, and then probably see them the next day. They're asking, should we go to the emergency room? And I'm like, well, you don't need to go sit in the emergency room for 4 hours. It doesn't make sense. It's not emergent. You have foot function. You have capillary refill. You have sensation. There's nothing else that we really need to do tonight. And then we see them the next day and then make the determination if their palpable tenderness goes up, their sensitivity is increased and elevated. Then we'll say, let's get you in to see the orthopedist. I think the conversation always goes around, is this a chronic injury? Is it an acute injury? People that have ankle sprains that didn't treat them appropriately, and then they have, you know, joint laxity. When does that operative, non-operative conversation come up if we're moving on to more of a chronic type situation?
In the vein of low versus high ankle sprain, what if you know you're treating it non-operatively, what's your average return to play for your, let's say, high school athlete versus high-level athlete? Because everyone, when their fantasy quarterback goes down, you know, high ankle sprain, all the talking heads freak out. And so what's a general rule, not rule, but just what's your advice, what's your return to play for most of these people?
For patients you're treating non-operatively, you're generally talking about your grade one, grade two injuries, right? So grade two, a little bit of, you know, instability, a little bit of widening. Grade, you know, grade three, those, especially in a higher level athlete, that's what I'm talking about. You know, this is something that we need to do surgery on. You're not really going to do better. You're not going to do well non-operatively. Typically, when they get to me, I decide, you know, are they able to bear weight on this? How far after the injury was it? You know, if this happened the day before, then yeah, maybe a couple days of non-weight bearing and immobilization would they benefit from. So again, putting them in a CAM boot to provide that immobilization, I wouldn't splint them. You know, some people would. If you trust your patient, if they're a young athlete, they're motivated to get back to play. I think it's important to allow them to do some range of motion in their ankle. You know, you can do some stretching, things like that. Whereas a splint, you know, pure immobilization might cause a little bit more stiffness, a little bit more atrophy in their gastroc soleus. So again, I put them in a CAM boot for a few days and then I start letting them do some partial weight bearing, basically weight bearing as tolerated, let them self-regulate with the goal of getting out of that CAM boot, you know, within a week, week and a half. And then really, you know, just kind of assessing where they're at, what their pain and symptoms are, talking with their athletic trainer, their physical therapist. You know, initially the goal is you want to get them walking in a regular shoe or athletic shoe with no limp. A quick and easy test that I always do to see if they're ready to start accelerating, you know, working back towards return to play is just single leg hop test. I'll either view it myself or I'll talk to the trainers. You know, if they can do a single leg hop test 10 times without any grimacing, without any fatigue, slowing down, that's generally a good sign that they're ready to be challenged a little bit. And then going from there, usually I like the use of a brace. I tell my patients that I want you to be able to have a little bit of confidence in your ankle and have that external stability. So that way, as you're rehabbing and getting back to return to play, you can focus on the skills of your sport and not just whether your ankle is strong enough. I say that with my knee patients. I say that with my foot and ankle patients. I let them do linear activities and then I start letting them do ballistic side-to-side activities with plyometrics. And then once they're able to achieve that, then we start adding in non-contact drills, full contact drills. And then once they've felt like they are doing their activity pain-free, I'll let them return. For lower grade, if we're talking high ankle sprains, you may be out a month, 3 to 6 weeks, depending on how severe it is. I say mentally prepare for a month. Some people a little more, some people are a little less. For your low ankle sprains, you know, you can see some pretty severe swelling and, you know, ecchymosis bruising, but generally those patients recover relatively quickly, assuming that there's no peroneal tendon dislocation or tear, assuming that there's no chondral injury that they're dealing with, right? Assuming that they're not having some sort of like, you know, peroneal nerve neuritis from their inversion injury, like those patients recover relatively quickly. So like I said, I usually get them in an ankle brace, ice, compression, and then I get them moving. You know, I put them on a stationary bike have them just pedal. I have them work on some strengthening, some tendon mobilization. And then I kind of do the same rehab protocol that we were talking about with the high ankle sprain. And I tell them, you know, depending on the severity of this, we might be looking at 10 days to 2 weeks for some severe ones, or some patients who, you know, have a more exaggerated pain response, you know, or we might be looking at a month. I think part of it too is the mental readiness of the athlete. You'll see a lot of patients who, they are ready. They have no tenderness. They have no instability on exam, but just mentally, they don't feel confident. They don't feel ready. And then you'll have patients who can't do 10 single leg hops and are still tender. And they're like, I want to go back and play. Like, what can we do? So just kind of gauging those patients and kind of using that for your calculus in terms of when they're truly going to be ready to go back.
I love how you talked about the mental component, because we talk about this frequently. I was talking to one of Cam's mentors and one of mine, Dr. Thomas Gill, about this. And we're talking about the mental component of going and returning back to play. And we got to think of like what above your shoulders is a big, you know, component to people returning. And if they can't do it, they're not going to be ready, and they're going to always be hesitant, and they're going to run into, you know, either further injury or something else is going to happen to something else in their body. So I like that discussion on, you know, the ankle brace is going to give you a little bit more kind of external stability, and it's going to help you kind of achieve what you want to achieve. Going back to the rehab piece, I'm kind of in the same, you know, philosophy where we see an athlete, we see whatever the limitations are, whether it be swelling, range of motion, pain. Once we can get that controlled, we're going to move on through the protocol, manual resistive therapy, moving back to ballistic stuff at when they can do ballistic and proprioceptive rehabilitation. The good thing is that we're seeing them every single day of the week. It's not twice a week like PT. AT, we're seeing them every single day. We know them pretty well as athletes, so we can run them through a protocol a little bit faster given how their symptoms are actually improving day over day, because we're seeing them, we're providing those modalities, we're providing that external kind of support system for them, but we're also have our hands on them every single day. So I think that's a good thing too that you might end up seeing with some of the, you know, high school, collegiate, and professional athletes that you might see in your practice, is that it's a little different than, you know, an athlete that's coming in that plays tennis and they may be going just to see PT, you know, and they're playing tennis recreationally. So do you end up seeing that type of like change in the paradigm with your return to play with some of the athletes because they're working with an athlete trainer, they're a little more speedy? Or is that, you know, not the case depending on, I guess, age, gender? I think there's a, you know, kind of a few things that you have to kind of weigh out there.
Yeah, I mean, I am generally excited when I get a high school athlete or junior college athlete because they have an athletic trainer that is involved, that is communicative, that's someone I can give them my phone number, we can text about the athlete. And I find that those patients tend to do better and they get better faster than some patients who are more weekend warrior types, right? Playing sports recreationally. But when you're dealing with an HMO population, sometimes it can be a little bit delayed into getting in into physical therapy or even getting them into high quality physical therapy, right? Those physical therapists are not the most communicative. So those are the patients that generally might do a little bit slower just because they don't have access to the same resources that, you know, these younger high school and collegiate athletes do. So for me, you know, I give out my card, I give out my phone number. I really, you know, I tell the patients like, you know, get me in touch with your therapist. It's only going to do you, it's only going to help us clear the air, and it's only going to help you get better faster.
Let's say, unfortunately, some of these patients don't actually get better with non-operative or conservative treatment. Can you give us a general overview of operative treatment for low and high ankle sprains and then some rehab considerations in return to?
With the exception of like very few high grade, low ankle sprains, I'm pretty conservative as those patients tend to do pretty well with non-operative treatment. You know, if they have like an avulsion injury, I slow them down a little bit more and I'll immobilize them. Some of those patients, they'll get those non-unions though, if they're like little flex distal fibula fracture, and they can be pretty symptomatic. You'll know relatively early with those, you know, I would say within, you know, 3 to 6 months, they'll tell you, you know, it's painful, it's painful, it's painful. And, you know, that'll kind of force my hand into doing surgery. But generally, you know, for most 90% of the cases of low ankle sprains, again, where I'm not concerned about a cartilage injury, where I'm not concerned about a peroneal tendon injury, I'm, you know, the first, second, and third line of treatment is time physical therapy. High ankle sprains, you know, a little bit different. Again, when you have that kind of grade 3 sprain and you have, you know, diastasis of the tibia and the fibula, you get to surgery, or you know, you want to get the surgery relatively quickly. You know, in some of those patients, they might even have a proximal fibula fracture. So you get shortening, you get external rotation of the fibula. That's something that's generally not going to do well with non-operative treatment. So again, that's something I'm going to do, you know, within a week or so of them coming into my clinic. But I guess, you know, the more common thing is you have a patient who has had an ankle sprain. They got better, they return to sport, and maybe they're okay for a while, but then they have another ankle sprain, and then they rehab that, and they have another ankle sprain. And I start talking with them. I was like, you know, we don't have to do surgery on you. And this is more for your recreational athlete. You know, we don't have to do surgery on you ever. This can just kind of be your life. You can wear an ankle brace, you know, you can have activity modification, but if you're still going to do play football, play soccer, you're going to expect that you're going to continue to have these ankle sprains. And that's when I'll talk to them. Then that's time when you want to do consider some type of stabilization procedure. For the younger athletes, they, you know, if they go through a period of 6-8 weeks of PT and they're just still not able to return to sport, their complaint is instability, their complaint is pain, then that's a time where I won't tell them, hey, we just need more time, we need more rehab. That's when I'll see where they are in the season. If it's something that they want to put off until the end of the season, right? They can get through the season with taping, with anti-inflammatories, I'll let them. But if not, that's when I'll say, you know, we have to proceed to surgical management.
That makes sense. What do you want to talk about? You were talking about footwear. I want to talk about Achilles. Can we talk about Achilles first?
We can. I was going to ask a question on,
go ahead. Yeah.
On the laxity of the joint. So I think there's been some surgeons that we've worked with up here in Boston that, depending on how much laxity with a chronic ankle sprain, say a chronic ATFL sprain and say grade 3, and you treat it conservatively without surgery, what's the degree of laxity that somebody needs to have where you say, I need to fix this? And I guess it's a case by case. Is there any research that shows where that is more of an option for a patient just because of joint breakdown? I'm just thinking of chondral breakdown and osteoarthritis down the road. When does that conversation come into play for you as a surgeon?
You always want to assess side-to-side difference. You want to see if there is truly instability, you know, a lot of instability on one side compared to the other, or the injured side compared to the non-injured side. You want to factor in, is this a hypermobile patient, right? You know, so I've had plenty of patients where I feel their injured ankle, I get that clunk on my anterior drawer, and then I go and I feel their other ankle. Feels exactly the same. In some practices, you can consider doing stress x-rays where you're doing a talar tilt. And when you're having significant shift or tilting of that talus, you know, that might be an indication that this is a hyperlax or a very unstable ankle. You can see that on the AP, but you can even do one where you're doing a dynamic anterior draw on a lateral. And in some patients, you can almost see that talus being subluxated, nearly dislocated out of the tibial talar joint. So that's a patient that I'll do that I'll be more aggressive about recommending surgery for, you know. And then in these chronic ankle sprain patients, it's not just the ATFL, you know, generally they'll have some CFL laxity. One thing I always am concerned about is a little bit of subtalar instability. So generally I'm not just fixing the ATFL. I'll make sure that I tighten and imbricate the CFL as well, just to mitigate any instability at that subtalar joint. And then, you know, the last thing I'll highlight is in these, it's not always either they have a low ankle sprain or a high ankle sprain. You know, there can be a mixed picture, especially in these chronically unstable patients. So, you know, I will either do intraoperatively, you know, I'll always plan to I'll have everything available if I need to fix the syndesmosis and to do a lateral ankle stabilization. I'll stress them intraoperatively. If I'm scoping them for any reason, I'll assess it intraoperatively. If not, I'll do, you know, your cotton tests and your external rotation stress tests intraop before I decide whether they're only going to get a lateral procedure or they're going to get a syndesmosis procedure.
So that's a great explanation. I think like you had mentioned, it's just, it varies. You know, you have to be able to compare bilaterally what's going on with the patient to really get a good understanding for that and what they're really dealing with and what you want to do conservatively versus surgically.
Well, how much ankle arthroscopy are you doing in this? How much ankle arthroscopy fits into the sports foot and ankle practice?
I mean, again, it all depends, right? If I see for these acute patients, you know, I'm just checking an x-ray. I'm seeing if you can see that lucency in the, you know, the talus to see if they have an osteochondral lesion. If they're not getting much better with PT, that's when I'll get an MRI. And I wouldn't do surgery on someone before getting an MRI, and that'll kind of give me a sense of whether they have any issues, or they have any cartilage lesions. If they don't, I'm not super aggressive about arthroscopy unless it's a really, really, you know, it's a much younger patient, even a high level athlete. But, you know, if I, you know, outside of the world of ankle sprains, right, you know, I do see a decent amount of osteochondral lesions of the talus. In a syndesmotic injury, you know, I'll tend to want to put a scope in just to make sure that the deltoid ligament, you know, that you can get a lot of tearing of that deltoid ligament, check the medial gutter, make sure there's not a, like, you know, piece interposed that needs to be repaired. Obviously, I'll check the stability preoperatively and postoperatively. Also, in these patients who have these chronic instability, sometimes you'll see that anterior tibial osteophyte. So, you know, I want to go in there. I want to take that down prior to doing their stabilization, just because they probably have a bit of Achilles contracture from their chronic instability and from that osteophyte. And, you know, you're gonna put them in a, you're gonna do their procedure, you're gonna put them in a splint that's gonna make that contracture worse. So at least addressing that osteophyte, getting them to neutral, and then letting them progress from there with PT. It's one of the, you know, the advantages of a adding a scope procedure.
That's awesome.
I want to talk about Achilles. Is that cool?
Yeah, let's do it.
I figure Achilles is super common.
Interestingly enough, we've been seeing more and more younger populations with Achilles trauma, yeah, that, which is interesting.
I want to find out why. So, Mike, if you have adolescent patient or weekend warrior patient who's just started marathon training or is playing a lot of pickup basketball, starts having posterior heel pain, difficulty pushing off, and you feel that they're developing disorder of the Achilles, Achilles tendonitis, what do you do with those patients when you see them in clinic? And then how do you possibly rehab them and even prevent them from going on to a bigger injury such as Achilles rupture?
Yeah, so you don't want to, you want to see where they are in, you know, their in their presentation, right? This just happened. Has this been going on for a while? Where are they tender? Are they inflamed in their fat pad? Are they having a little like retrocochlear bursitis? Or is this truly a tendonitis, tendinosis? You know, you check the shape of the Achilles. Is there thickening? Are they tender at the mid-substance of the Achilles? Or are they tender more distal at the insertion? Do they have something like a Haglund's deformity or a pump bump? I check their motion to make sure that they don't have a positive Silver Skull test, because that would indicate a gastroc contracture. Say, you know, say you're a weekend warrior basketball player, right? They started noticing some pain with playing, and they have a little bit of swelling. What I'll typically do when they come is I'll get them in a I'll give them some heel lifts, and I'll have them walk with their regular shoe with 3 3/4 inch heel lifts for a couple of weeks. I will give them a stretching program, whether guided by PT or not. I always encourage doing everything under the guidance of a physical therapist, but I give them some home exercises to work on. I demonstrate that. I'm a big fan of use of a night splint. So just you know, a thermoplastic splint that they wear before bed. I tell them, do your stretches before bed, put this on. You'll kick it off within the first hour, the first time you wear it, but over time you'll get more used to it. I think that can be very beneficial. You know, we all kind of, as we sleep, we curl our wrists, we curl our ankles, and everything in the morning gets super tight. And patients will complain, yeah, that first step that I take, I feel like, you know, whether they have plantar fasciitis, they'll have that heel pain, or if they have Achilles tendonitis, tendinosis, they'll have that ankle pain. So I'll recommend that night splint. I'll put them on some anti-inflammatories if they can tolerate them, both oral and topical. If they're not getting much better, you know, and we have to do a little bit more aggressive, you know, I will recommend some extracorporeal shockwave therapy, which can have some benefit. If you look at some of this data in terms of like biologics, PRP, things, it's pretty mixed. I don't push PRP on everyone, or I don't use that as a, I don't make them do PRP prior to other treatment modalities, just because of the out-of-pocket expense that it can have. You know, some clinics in the Los Angeles area, they charge an exorbitant amount for, I won't call anyone out or say the prices, but, you know, definitely, you know, there's no regulation right now in terms of what people are charging for PRP. So for something that it's not clinically proven, I'm not forcing patients to do that. There's some better data in terms of bone marrow aspirate in the use in Achilles tendonitis, tendinosis. But, you know, that's really hard to obtain from a patient. If you have a procedure room, you know, in your clinic, you know, you can You can try to harvest some bone marrow aspirate from the iliac crest, but generally these are patients that need some anesthesia. You have to take them to the operating room just to harvest it. So it becomes a full procedure, which may or may not, for you as the physician, you may or may not get reimbursed for that procedure for your time, right? EMAC can be even more expensive than PRP. You know, the OR time might get reimbursed or might get covered by insurance. Your time generally doesn't, as there really isn't a great CPT code for that. So unless you're charging the patient out of pocket, that might not be, you're not going to see a lot of physicians that are going to do that routinely when there's operative cases that need to be done.
We've had some patients that have had shockwave up here in Boston, and they've had pretty good results. Not everybody does it. There's clinics that are around that do it, and they get referred usually by the referring physician. If we're not having the best outcome with traditional therapy, or we're kind of stuck in, I call it the Maytag spin cycle. We're just, you know, we're getting better a little bit. We're falling back. We're getting better. We're falling back. And depending on what they're doing, but I have to agree with the night splint. They suck. Like, nobody wants to wear them. They put them on. They get caught on the covers. They can't turn over in bed, but they do work. And those are the things that help to elongate the Achilles and make you feel better. And I always talk about heel lifts. And we've had a podiatrist that came and spoke to us, did an in-service. And he said that the three things that I give patients, heel lifts, calf raises, and stretching. Like, those are things that are going to make you better. And obviously the manual therapy and modalities and therapy that are going to help. And then if that all does not work and it's not doing what it needs to do, then we'll talk about other interventions that you had alluded to, if that seems to be something they need to do moving down the road.
Are there operative indications for those who fail, those with Achilles tendonitis, tendinopathy, tendinosis that fail long-term conservative treatment?
Yeah, I think it depends on what you're dealing with. You know, are you dealing with a mid-substance tendinosis, right? Are you dealing with insertional tendonitis? Are you dealing with a Haglund's deformity, right? You know, you get an MRI to see how much tendon involvement is. Is the tendon quality good? Are there fibrillations? Is there tendon breakdown? If you're just dealing with someone who's having more of like a tenosynovitis, right? Painful tendon, the tendon quality overall looks good. Generally, that patient has a gastroc contracture. So that's someone that I'll do, you know, a gastroc resection on. And those patients, they get pretty good. They get pretty good fast. For patients who are more like insertional tendonitis, it kind of depends. If they have that big Haglund's deformity, you know, you can get away, which is kind of taking that down. If there's not much involvement in the tendon, those patients can be better. But if, say, you're dealing with your raging case of insertional tendonitis, that's someone that you have to debride the tendon, you have to take down the Haglund's deformity. You're basically essentially doing a re-repair of the tendon back down to the calcaneus, and the recovery from that is a major procedure. And the recovery from that, you know, in terms of return to sport, can be anywhere between, you know, 4 to 6 months, depending on how big the repair is in some patients. Now, there are some newer studies that I've, you know, some newer techniques that I've seen where people are doing almost like a flexion osteotomy of the calcaneus. So not touching the Achilles at all, but taking a wedge out of the Achilles and almost kind of doing a closing wedge dorsally. And if you kind of can picture the calcaneus in your mind's eye, that's almost kind of bringing the Achilles just a little bit more, or the heel, the insertion a little bit more proximal, taking tension off that Achilles. Mm-hmm. I've seen some good results with that. You know, there are a lot of people on the vanguard of foot and ankle surgery, and, you know, a lot of foot and ankle fellowships now are offering minimally invasive procedures. So stab incisions and high speed burrs, as opposed to your bigger incisions and your saws, to minimize the amount of soft tissue damage. So as those advances in, you know, the minimally invasive surgery progress, then I think you'll see more people kind of adopting procedures that, you know, more osteotomy type procedures.
Have you tried one of those yet personally?
It wasn't something I was trained on. I've done it in the lab. I mean, my foot and ankle volume is not so high where that's, or I would rather say this, the demand in my patient population, I don't have a lot of patients that are interviewing doctors whether they're going to do minimally invasive versus open procedures. You know, if patients want to do minimally invasive procedures, there's a couple of physicians here in the Los Angeles area that I will refer them to. Generally, no, I'm able to kind of do the procedures that I want without having to worry about minimally invasive procedures. But if I didn't have such a varied practice, right? You know, if I wasn't taking care of a lot of knee pathology, that might be something I would want to add more to my armamentarium.
Now, if you have a patient that is like a tenosynovitis and they're just not getting better, What's the intervention? What would you be your next intervention other than therapy? I mean, therapy's not working. Where do you go with that patient?
I mean, again, I talk about, you know, we talked about shockwave therapy, offer them acupuncture. If that patient wants to explore the use of PRP, I'll do that under ultrasound guidance while I kind of just get right under the peritoneum and inject some PRP. You know, patients ask me, do I need to do this once? Do I need to do that three times? And kind of my answer is, it depends. I don't want to force anyone to do that. And, you know, I say sometimes these things can get you better and we can avoid a surgery, but it can be costly. The patients that were enrolled in studies where they got three or five injections, they didn't have to pay for those injections, whereas these patients, they have to. So I just basically say, why don't we try one? Let's see if you get any better after 3-4 weeks. If you got 0% better, then I'm not going to make you do more. But if, you know, if we're noticing a difference, that might be an avenue to do a series of injections if they, you know, if they're willing to and, you know, they're fine with the out-of-pocket costs. But, you know, if none of these things are helping, that's, again, that's someone I probably would do a gastroc resection on. Quick, easy procedure. It takes, you know, 15, 20 minutes for most people. It's outpatient. You can do it through small incisions, relatively low-risk procedures. I generally try to avoid surgery for most patients. But for these patients, you know, I tell them this is something quick and easy, and I think you'll notice the difference within a month after surgery. They're usually game for it.
What's the recovery timeline in that type of procedure?
I let them weight bear in a cam boot with heel lifts right after surgery to protect the incision. Some people will splint it, and I think that's fine too. I'm a big fan of just kind of mobilization. I don't want them to get atrophy and stiffness secondary to, you know, my method of immobilization. And then kind of going back to what we talked about in the rehab milestone. So I'll get them on a stationary bike. I'll have them do body weight exercises, heel lifts, calf raises. I want them to be able to do double leg calf raises, then single leg calf raises, then single leg hops. And then from there, again, I'll progress them into more dynamic activities.
That's great. And as we're going down the path, I think of Cam was asking about Achilles pathology. You have an Achilles repair and you're putting them in a cam boot with the heel lift. What's your progression out of the boot? How do you operate with your patients on progression through therapy to the point where they're out of the boot? Are you at 6 weeks, 8 weeks? When do you start to pull back on the heel lift?
I generally will keep them in a splint and resting plantar flexion based off of you know, how my repair was for 2 weeks.
Okay.
Maybe a little longer. You know, the back of the ankle, the blood supply is not the best. So for some patients, maybe your older patients, you know, who might have a smoking history or some other comorbidities, I might keep them in the splint and the stitches in a little bit longer.
Okay.
And then from there, I take the stitches out. I will put them in a cam boot, either two or three heel lifts, just kind of matching what their resting Aquinas is, their resting plantar flexion is. And then I start them on a weight bearing progression. I let them be 20% weight bearing in that cam boot with their heel lifts. Every 2 days, I let them increase by 10%. So over the course of 2 weeks, they're off of crutches completely. So that puts us about 4 weeks after surgery off crutches. And then from there, depending on the number of heel lifts, I'll have them start taking heel lifts out. So if they have three heel lifts, I'll want them to just kind of walk for a week with the boot, with the heel lifts, same with two, and then have them go down from there. And then once they're at one heel lift, I'll have them take one of those extra heel lifts, put it in their regular shoe. And then I want them to split their time between the shoe and the cam boot, first starting with just an hour in the morning, hour in the evening, every couple of days, increasing that amount of time till they're exclusively in a regular shoe. So what I say is they could probably expect to be in a regular shoe full time after about 10 weeks after surgery. They can take the cam boot off to shower. They can take it off for physical therapy. They can take it off for sleep. But when they can kind of put that thing in the closet and forget about it, it's usually about 2.5 months.
Yeah, that's about the same that we end up seeing. So I just wanted to, you know, put into context of what we're seeing. And it sounds like it's about the same.
I think there's been a shift in terms of aggressive, more early weight bearing and aggressive rehab with these Achilles tendon tears because, again, prolonged immobilization, stiffness, weakness, atrophy. We've seen studies that there isn't really a difference in elongation of the tendon post-repair, whether they were immobilized for a long time or a short time. Maybe a slightly increased risk of some wound complications, but only slightly. I think the benefits of getting them walking, getting them mobilized far out, especially in your younger athletes, far outweigh any other potential risks.
And the reason why I kind of started off with the tenosynovitis is that we have a pretty large population of, and Cam knows this, I mean, we have a huge golfing population, a lot of undulating courses where people are walking a lot of pickleball, which is the fastest growing paddle sport, I think, in the country per capita, like as we're starting to see, and then more tennis stuff. So we tend to see some of these Achilles tendon pathologies that aren't tears, but more you know, the tendonitises and the things and the tendinosises that we're seeing. So it's good just to be able to discuss, you know, kind of what the understanding is as far as the rehabilitation and the outcomes and other therapies that are available if traditional physical therapy is not working.
So unfortunately, go ahead, Mike.
Oh, I was going to say, for the, you know, for those, for this aging population, you know, the pickleballers, the golfers, you know, when I see them, I tell them, and I stole this from a comedian. I was like, these exercises are what you do now. This is just what you, this is just your life, right? Like, if you want to get better, you want to prevent these flare-ups, this is just what you do now. And I don't know if Cam remembers this, but we had an attending at UChicago who used to say that these exercises are like hygiene. They're like brushing your teeth, and you don't brush your teeth only when they hurt. You brush them all the time. So kind of the combination of this is what you do now, and this is your daily routine.
Yeah, that's great. I use that all the time, actually.
All the time.
With physical therapy.
Yeah.
So a small percentage of these patients, unfortunately, go on to the full thickness Achilles rupture. And I remember as a resident, non-operative versus operative treatment was very controversial, and I'm sure continues to be very controversial. So can you give us a brief overview of, in general, who gets surgery, who doesn't get surgery, what are the factors, and then an overview of surgery open versus minimally invasive?
Yeah, you know, it is controversial. I think this paradigm shifts, you know, every 5-10 years. The AOFAS came out with a consensus statement a couple years ago, basically saying that there is an avenue for non-operative treatment, even in the athlete. I kind of think it all depends, especially if you're just, you know, if you're orthopedic surgeon, community-based practice, we try to think, you know, who is the patient that's going to do well from surgery? Who's the patient that doesn't really need surgery? You know, so your older patients, your weekend warriors, those are people that I think generally can do fine with non-operative treatment. Now, it's a matter of how quickly are they seeking out treatment, right? If you have someone who had the typical felt a kick in the back of my ankle and then didn't really think anything of it and let it go for 3 weeks, they're walking on it, right? Those tendon edges had no chance to, you know, there's no tendon apposition. That's going to heal in an elongated position. And, you know, they can probably walk without pain, but if they're trying to get back to their sport, they're going to notice that they don't have the same push-off strength. So that's someone that might force your hand in terms of doing a surgery with more subacute timing. Now, say you see that person early, I tell them, I think you can do fine with non-operative treatment. I think what you might notice is less push-off strength, although there's some studies that refute that. I think you will definitely not have this risk of infection and blood clot and nerve damage that you might get with the surgery. But I think if you're adamant that you're really trying to get back to your sport, you're trying to get back as quickly as possible, even if you are a recreational athlete, then surgery is a viable option. The Achilles tendon, it's in a huge tendon sheath. There's good blood supply in that area. They love to heal. That's why I think non-operative treatment is very viable, or viable rather. You know, in the younger athletic population, I think I'm hard-pressed to see anyone who's going to treat them non-operatively. One, just because high healing potential, those patients have a relatively low risk of, you know, your blood clots, your infections. But mainly, you know, there is concern, you know, especially if you're talking to a parent about operative versus non-operative treatment, you know, your kid might have a little bit less push-off strength weakness pop in that leg. They're going to say, absolutely not. Like, my kid wants to play their sport. So I think most, more often than not, you're treating these operatively. Now, interestingly, what in this consensus statement, they talked about the role for ultrasound and determining whether it's operative or non-operative. You know, it requires you having an ultrasound in your clinic. It requires you being a facile user of the ultrasound. But they said generally, if you get to a patient within 4 days, 1 week of the injury, and when you get them into maximal plantar flexion, if you're noticing that those tendon edges are within 5 millimeters, if you can get them within 5 millimeters, and you can splint them there, those patients, they tend to do pretty well with non-operative treatment. Now, again, like I said, you have to have access to an ultrasound. You have to be pretty confident in your ability to use it and read it. So I have not started making clinical decisions based off the ultrasound. The way I generally use it is patients, I say, Achilles tears are a clinical diagnosis, right? Based off physical exam. They all ask for an MRI. I say, I don't think I really need it, you know, and I do my best not to sound cocky when I say that. It's just, you know, we know that you have an Achilles tear. So I'll break out the ultrasound. I'll show them the tendon gapping, and generally they're pretty satisfied with that, and they'll be willing to proceed with surgery. In terms of your, you know, open, mini open versus your minimally invasive, I think the answer is like, yes, just kind of get those tendon edges opposed. I use a mini open approach just because that's what I was taught at the Stedman Clinic. Use what's kind of a, Cam, you would know, it's like kind of a modified Kessler suture. I'll do three modified Kessler sutures with a fiber tape with epitendinous stitch, close the peritoneum, and then, you know, just some nylons over the incision. There was a study out of Vail that showed that that was the, you know, time zero strongest construct compared to your Krakow suture and your PARs and your other Achilles repair devices. You know, good enough for the athletes at the Stedman Clinic, good enough for my patients. And it's a relatively easy, reproducible procedure. I can generally repair most through a 3-centimeter incision, so not a lot of soft tissue dissection. You know, you create a nice mobile window. I do think that there is a role for some of the more minimally invasive procedures. You know, you probably heard of the PARs, which is one of the vendor's products. And that's kind of what everyone thinks of, you know, they want the Aaron Rodgers, you know, so he got a variation of the PARs, which involves getting a lot of stitches in the proximal tendon and then taking all those stitches and docking them in the heel. I think it is a robust repair. Again, in the lab, it hasn't shown that it's any stronger than more direct repairs, but you know, you do have that anchoring in the heel to prevent any more kind of like proximal migration. One concern with that is, you know, you're making bigger stab incisions on the back of the heel and you kind of have to drill through that soft tissue. So there can be some wound healing issues, but more commonly patients can complain of heel pain for a long time. You're putting these 4 or 5 millimeter anchors under tension into their heel with not a lot of soft tissue coverage. You have to make sure you sink those anchors. There's going to be edema in the bone for quite some time. So, you know, there's been some modifications to the technique that the company will say will reduce the amount of heel pain. But for me, it's just something that I try to avoid. You know, you're trying to think about what can make a patient not happy. So I just kind of don't even factor that into my equation. I usually have it on backup just in case. You know, sometimes these tears, they're poor quality and you can't really get good, you can't get a suture purchase with a direct repair. So the PARs can be a good salvage just to get some more proximal capture of the tendon and dock it into heel. But otherwise I could say I could, you know, 95% of the tears I've been able to repair directly.
I'm going to put you on the spot. So you go out this weekend and you're playing pickleball with your fiance and you rupture your Achilles. Do you get it fixed?
Let me say two things. I think if me knowing how to treat an Achilles tear, I think that if I know that I have an Achilles tear, I get splinted that day, I'll do just fine. That's going to heal. I'll be out of the splint, you know, in a month, 6 weeks, you know, I'll kind of be back running, playing sports 6-ish, 9 months. I think I probably would still get it fixed. Now I'm 37. I ski pretty aggressively. I bike, I run, getting into my weekend warrior years, but I still have a little bit of an ego about myself, my athletic performance. Go to one of my colleagues who I trust to do my Achilles. I think the main factor for me would be just the time out of getting out of the boot, getting back to weight bearing. I don't think as a surgeon, I could tolerate being on crutches in a cast for 4 weeks, 6 weeks, right? You know, I need to get back operating, need to get back seeing patients. So if I can get repaired acutely, be out of a, you know, out of a splint, back walking within 2 weeks, you know, operating, as you know, surgery is like a sport for us. This is our sport, our profession, and we kind of need to be our healthiest and, you know, in our best shape. So that would factor into my decision-making.
Cam, did you not ask me because of my age and know that I'm only going to get it repaired?
You would be non-Mike. The Dr. Mike Perrone over here would treat you non-operatively in a heartbeat.
I would be, I'd have to err on the side of, you know what? Because of my profession, I'd get it repaired just because I got to be able to run across a field and save a life, you know? So for me, if I'm still practicing, I got to be able to do that in a timely fashion. But I can't be off my feet really that much, but I could still scooter around, still have a golf cart.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of, you know, as you know, when you're talking with patients, there's a little bit of like finesse here. And, you know, if I see that 52-year-old who tore his Achilles and I'm like, you're going to be fine without surgery. Some guys are like, what do you mean, man? Like, no, I'm like, I'm still going at it. I'm still going pretty hard. What do you mean I don't need surgery, right? And you got to lay out the data for them. Yeah, I say that you're going to do just fine. I really try to sell them on the risks of surgery, right? Infection. A lot of times they're just like, hey, no, I'm still an athlete. My best years are still ahead of me. You're like, all right, fine. Usually they have like a pretty no tolerance policy for anyone with, you know, some comorbidities though in that setting. Diabetic smoker, right? I say, if you want to have surgery, you know, you can go somewhere else. I just, you know, I think you're going to do fine without surgery, and I'm not going to assume the risk of your care.
Yeah, no, I agree. You're spot on. We have to always look at, you know, the comorbidities with a lot of our patients too. Like we see them in therapy where they have, you know, repairs done and their tissue quality is poor and they just don't do well. And they don't understand, even though we keep talking about how to improve their lifestyle, that doesn't help them much. You know, it just really sets them up for a poor outcome. And it sounds like you're doing the right thing and making sure that you're doing the right thing for your patients and giving them all the options available.
Achilles, just kind of harp going back to, you know, talking about what are the things that will make a patient unhappy. You know, Achilles is one of those where the risks or the complications aren't present. I don't know if they're what equivalent procedure you would have, CAM and hand surgery, but it is not zero. You know, it is infection in Achilles is a lot more than infection in ACLs, right? You know, and if you do 25 a year or more, you might expect, you know, maybe one or two of those patients is going to get infected. And that's, you know, that's a scary thing to deal with. Especially when it was a kind of a 50-50 call in terms of, do you really need surgery? You know, you just feel really awful if you push a patient towards surgery and they have one of these complications. So again, generally, I just kind of see where the patient is at and I lay out the facts, and then we kind of go from there. We make a decision together.
Now, as far as age, I mean, patients with full thickness tears being younger, because I'm seeing more of this. When I first started practicing, we never really saw a lot of it. It was always the older populations. What do you attribute it to, and what are you seeing in your population where you're starting to see younger patients with full thickness tears?
It's hard to blame anything in particular, but I think what I would probably say is as youth athletics has just gotten more and more popular, then you see a more push towards sport specialization. So athletes, when they're very young, they pick one sport and they're doing that year round, which we know is just not good for a multitude of things. Higher risk for injury, higher risk of burnout and fatigue, quitting their sport, lower performance. You know, you see that the athletes that are participating in different sports in the fall, spring, summer season, they have better skills in general and better injury prevention because using different muscles in different ways. So if you're a 14-year-old girl and you're playing soccer 11 months out of the year, right, you're not doing anything differently. You're actually just playing soccer. You're not doing any strength and conditioning. And you're setting yourself up for Achilles tear, a whole host of things.
Yeah.
So I think that's what I would probably attribute it to, not anything, you know, I don't think there's anything else like diet or the way we're training our athletes. I think it's just you have these people playing one sport for a whole year.
Yeah.
No, I'd have to agree. Cam, do you have anything that you're seeing on your end?
We do have a small subset of 10 to 17-year-old patients who come in with vague shoulder pain. Usually in the male population, it's through their time in the weight room, and then the female population will either be gymnasts or swimmers. It's less of the multidirectional instability and more of the scapulothoracic dyskinesis, so the abnormal movement of the shoulder blade against the chest wall and affecting the shoulder kinematics, and it's the imbalance of what we call the periscapular muscles or the muscles around the shoulder blade that control the movement of your arm. So it's almost 100% therapy, strengthening those muscles. Sometimes it's positional and posture. And I'm sure, Riz, that a lot of those adolescents will end up in your training room or the clinic. And usually it just, once they get some good instruction, some hands-on instruction, and then some home exercises, and then they grow a little, usually they're fine.
Yeah, I have three overhead athletes right now that I'm seeing at school that just what you're explaining, you know, start of the spring season, starting to have, you know, shoulder pain. You take a look at them kinematically, their scapula is a mess, winging scapula, upward tipping, downward rotation, and just they can't even hit a baseball. They try to hit a baseball, they get anterior shoulder pain. So yeah, there's a lot of that goes on. And it's, well, a lot of it is specialization, like you had mentioned, you know, it's being specialized, that's all they're doing, and not, you know, getting in the weight room to do the preventative activities, and then being a kid and just playing other sports. They're on the computer, they're sitting at a desk, they're on their phone, their forward posture, forward head lean, and that's what you're getting with a lot of the kids these days. So I think instruction and education is key to get them where they need to be, but I couldn't agree more.
I know we're running a little bit short on time, but I'd love to talk about running shoes very briefly.
Footwear.
Footwear in general. So Mike is a former marathon runner. I don't know if you're a current marathon runner, but he did run a sub 3-hour marathon and qualified for the Boston Marathon. If I'm not correct, please correct me. But I'd love to hear a little bit about footwear for just running, weekend warrior, what you see people come in, what you recommend in general, what to look for when buying your first pair of running shoes or cleats or basketball shoes.
And be honest, shitty footwear, tell us. We want to know.
Yeah. We want to know.
I won't call out any specific brands. And I'm not a retired runner, but I'm planning my next phase of my running career.
Ultra marathons?
No, I don't think I'm ever going to get to that point. You know, time is limited. And I have a fiance that I'd like enjoy to spend my time with. But I told her, you know, if she ever leaves me, then I'll probably train for a ultra marathon or, you know, an ultra try. She's keeping me from achieving those crazy running goals. As she sits across the room, shaking her head.
Happy wife, happy life.
That's right. That's how it works.
So let me just talk a little bit about, like, you know, athletic footwear before going back to the running footwear. You know, I generally try to push patients with foot and ankle issues, a shoe with a wider toe box. You know, a lot of soccer cleats, basketball shoes, football cleats, they're quite narrow. And then as you have athletes that are a bit bigger, you have bigger guys, you know, you'll have their foot overhanging the midsole of the shoe. And that's what you'll see more susceptibility to stress fractures, metatarsalgia, you know, Jones fractures, even ankle sprains. So I will tend to push them again towards those shoes with the wider toe box. I think when you're assessing patients in their footwear, you want to take a look at what the shoes that they're using, and you want to look at the wear pattern of their shoes. So, you know, you have patients that could be either loading it too medially, too laterally, and that's something that you want to take into account when you're recommending a specific type of footwear, or even an insole. You know, some patients who have a little bit more, or a little more flat foot, more heel valgus, or a little more cable varus, they might benefit from an orthotic to put in their shoe to put them their ankle back in more neutral alignment. When you're talking about running shoes, my general stance is I don't think there really is one specific shoe for everyone. I think if you are a marathoner, you're training for a race, you're running multiple times a week, you're doing different types of runs, those are people I'd say you should have different running shoes for different types of runs. Now, I'm not saying everyone needs to do this, but back when I was running 6 days a week, I had six pairs of running shoes that I would use a different shoe for each type of run based off of what I was trying to achieve that day. Now, no one has to be that crazy. Just kind of understanding the spirit of the recommendation. The reason for that is you know, if you're going to be doing your 20 miler at a steady pace, maybe you want something with a little bit more cushioning, a little more support, right? If you're going to be doing 800 meter repeats or 400 meter repeats on a track, maybe you want something with lower drop, you know, less cushioning, a little bit lighter of a shoe. If you're just kind of doing your daily 6 miles, then that's when you can get into your just kind of regular everyday trainers, right? You don't really need to get too specific with it. You know, I wouldn't, you know, they have some of these super shoes now, you know, that some of the companies are making. Everyone has their foams and their insoles. They are great and people are running faster races because of it, but that's not something you should be training in. That's not something you should be doing your daily mileage. That's something that you're going to do maybe your tune-up run in and you're going to do your race in. And then, you know, everyone always asks about the minimalist shoes, the toe shoes, barefoot running. And I am not diametrically opposed to any of them. I think there's some companies that have the zero drop shoes that I think are benefiting. So the drop meaning the difference between where your toes are and where your heel is. Mm-hmm. There are some companies that will have a cushioned shoe, but the toes and the heel are on the same plane. So the heel being elevated. I think those are great. Those are supportive shoes. I think those can, you know, play a good role. Those can be a good tool in your training. The same with the barefoot shoes. But what I always recommend people who are interested in those type of shoes is you can't buy a pair and all of a sudden that's your running shoe. You know, especially someone who has been running for a while, you're so accustomed to these shoes with maximum cushioning with a big stack height that you can't just go straight to barefoot or zero drop shoes. So I say, if you're interested in barefoot running, go do your 5 mile run and then go find a park that has some grass and just run around that barefoot for a while. That way you get used to what it feels like to run barefoot with no cushioning, like out in the environment. Someone once told me that we evolved as runners, but we didn't evolve to run on asphalt. I have seen people who have stress fractures, metatarsalgia, cuts to their foot because they started taking up barefoot running. So it can be something that you ease into, but not something that needs to be all or
nothing. Oh, that's a really great detailed explanation of footwear, which I thought was great. To round out, I think, the conversation today, the discussion about cleats and turf shoes, I think that's a big thing that we talk about. Is there recommendations as a foot and ankle orthopedist or a lower extremity orthopedist? Do you ever talk to athletes about wearing cleats that are replaceable, circular cleats versus turfs versus formed, I guess, molded cleats that are more triangular or square in relation? And, what might those recommendations be?
I think it depends on their playing surface. There's some, take football or soccer, for example, there's some kids playing on turf fields and there's some kids playing on, grass fields that aren't very well maintained. So I kind of get a sense of what their playing conditions are before I recommend a specific type of cleat. And then you gotta have to get a sense of what their resources are, do they have the availability to get a molded triangular cleat, or are they kind of sticking with your, basic, lug type cleat model? So I don't really have a, there really isn't one or the other that I say you absolutely, this is better for you. It's really just kind of based off of the conditions and the resources that are available to them. In terms of like when to get back into cleats in their return to sport, generally I want them to be able to do their activities on flat ground, on a track or in a gym with regular shoes prior to them putting on a cleat, just because of the inherent torque and the stop and go that can have on their ankle, their foot.
That's great. Good explanation. I think it all comes down to, like you said, availability, surface they're playing on. I think also pre-existing injury, sometimes people get a little more recommendation towards, at least what I've seen, like if they're, returning from an ACL reconstruction, they might go to a turf shoe if they're a soccer player versus, a cleat, depending on their surface. I think obviously comfortable fit as well and function is also a thing that you have to look into. Dr. Perrone, I do appreciate your time today. I thought it was a great conversation. I know we got a lot of information in there packed into an hour. I value your time and your expertise, as well as Dr. Roth, who asks more of the research-based, more educational questions than I can. So thank you for coming on today.
Yeah, Mike, thank you so much. Your knowledge of foot and ankle and lower extremity sports is incredible. And I remember 4 or 5 years ago when we were residents together learning all this stuff at the same time. And, obviously you're 4 years into practice, you're incredibly experienced and just keep getting better. And I learned a lot today, even based on the knowledge I had when I was a resident. So thanks for sharing. And I'm sure a lot of people will gain a lot of insight and resources from you. So we appreciate it.
Happy to do it, guys. This was great. Really appreciate you having me on.
Thank you for tuning in to the Behind the Sports Medicine podcast, proudly sponsored by AJR Sports Science and Healthcare Consulting. At AJR, we are committed to offering a comprehensive range of exceptional services, including applied sports science analytics, healthcare and sports medicine consulting, and leadership and coaching development. To learn more about AJR, visit their website at ajrsportscience.com. This is your host, Andrew Rizzo.
And your co-host, Dr. Cameron Roth. If you enjoyed the content from today's episode, give us a like, leave a comment, and share on social media. You can find all of our episodes on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast. You can also follow us on Instagram, YouTube, or Twitter at Behind Sports Med Podcast.
Stay tuned for our next episode.